Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Today, Sean Kiernan, CEO of Green Gauge, is in conversation with Ferdisha Snag, financial services regulation lawyer at Cleary Gottlieb, Steen & Hamilton. Sean and Ferdisha discuss crypto asset regulation in the UK. Where do we stand now and how does it compare to the EU's MiCA regime, as well as the US's more hardline approach? How do we define different types of crypto assets and how can they be used for financing purposes? How is the regulatory landscape evolving and will it become more similar to traditional finance regulation or TradFi regulation? And last but not least, what is different about crypto and how will commercial law end up responding to that?
A warm welcome, Ferdisha, to The Gauge. I'm delighted to have you with us. I'd love to hear a little bit more about you and your background, how you got into crypto.
So thank you very much, Sean, and very good to be here. So I am a financial services regulation lawyer. I'm a counsel at Cleary Gottlieb, Steen & Hamilton, an international law firm in London, and I lead the UK FIG practice. So this is quite a broad practice, and you know, with the associate in my team, we cover regulations across the full range of financial services sectors in the UK, from bank regulation to payments and money to markets and investments to funds to ESG. So really across the piece. But I like to think of myself also as a financial lawyer, so not just a sort of regulatory lawyer. As a result of working a lot in prime brokerage at the start of my career, so I spent time on secondment at three investment banks in London in the first few years of my career. I developed a degree of sort of expertise in intermediated securities and financial collateral. And so that complemented my interest on the regulatory side in topics like client asset protection. So, you know, the crypto angle to all of this, it sort of comes naturally, I guess, with an interest in just in financial assets. And this is a new type of financial asset that obviously really piqued my interest. I started to write with my colleagues, you know, back in, I don't know, 2015, 2016 about what this would mean. And then, you know, it's been really sort of interesting to see the development. Obviously, it's been hard to know over time kind of when to buy into various periods of hype. You know, at one point it was all about Bitcoin, then it was all about the ICO, and now it's more about sort of digital assets more broadly, which I think is more interesting. And so it's been really interesting to follow that. I suppose the sort of emerging law of digital assets, you know, has really been a major area of interest for me. And so as I said, I focus on UK regulation and UK financial law. We also form part in our team of a broader European regulatory practice. So we continue to maintain some degree of familiarity and expertise in EU regulations, working with our colleagues in the European network, as well as our colleagues in the US. And so, you know, we try at Cleary to deliver a sort of very seamless transatlantic offering to clients. And that also really impacts the crypto, the digital assets piece as well, because you get these perspectives from, you know, across multiple jurisdictions and some of, you know, the biggest, most important financial centers in the world. Sort of working with colleagues who are familiar with that, it's been brilliant. More about me specifically. So I've been at Cleary now for 5 years. And before that, I trained and I spent a number of years at Freshfields. And I'm actually from the Caribbean, as I was saying. I'm from Grenada. And I always like to say that, you know, perhaps as a result of having that sort of background, I really love the city. I love working here and solving problems and working with people that I, you know, I really could not imagine when I was growing up in Grenada. And so, you know, I'm also sort of stereotypically Caribbean. I'm pretty unflappable. And, you know, I also like to think that I'm quite sort of passionate about this area of work. So again, that also carries across into this real interest in this new type of financial technology that could really kind of, you know, change financial markets globally. Not just in major centers like this, but it's really an exciting time to be practicing.
Completely agree. And I think the city is a fascinating place to do business. I'd be curious to hear, having got in so early, 2015, 2016, have you had any cases you can talk, very broad brushstrokes of work that you've done at Cleary in the crypto space?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say, I suppose the one thing that really characterizes our work at Cleary on digital assets is that it's really traditional regulatory and financial law work with a sort of crypto asset flavor. So at the moment, I would say there's not really yet a digital assets law. That's possibly emerging as the technology kind of becomes more sort of ubiquitous and pervasive. But for now, it's really applying traditional legal frameworks, regulatory frameworks to a variety of questions. So on the regulatory side, you have the basic perimeter question. Is this regulated or not? Do you need a license in order to carry on a particular activity? And then that sort of carries on into M&A transactions that we've worked on where our clients are interested in acquiring crypto asset businesses and they want to know if this target has been operating in accordance with the regulatory framework. So the due diligence on sort of crypto asset business and how you sort of characterize businesses from a regulatory perspective. Then we've done corporate work for crypto asset firms trying to work out where to set up. So that sort of takes into account both the, you know, general corporate law and corporate legal frameworks in different jurisdictions, but also the regulatory framework there. Like, you know, if you want to sort of base a business, maybe you want to base it somewhere where it's relatively friendly to crypto or at least stable. And so that's been a question. We've worked on tokenization projects. So sort of traditional clients having traditional sort of asset classes like deposit, bank deposits or loyalty schemes and wanting to tokenize that to convert that into some sort of digital asset. And again, what's the regulatory framework? What are the legal implications of that? Bankruptcy and restructuring. So my colleagues in the US have been very active in that in the crypto winter, both on the sort of debtor side, so acting for firms undergoing crypto asset businesses, undergoing restructuring, but also acting for creditors of FTX, for example. So that's been really interesting. And even though that work is primarily led out of the US, there've been some interesting questions for us. So some products, for example, are characterized like e-money, for example, and our colleagues are like, what is e-money? And, you know, it's been great to kind of have to kind of explain that to them. Or trust law, you know, if assets were held in a certain way, is that a trust? Is that something else? Do customers have a beneficial interest in their assets? Or does it belong to the insolvent debtor? And so that's been interesting. Our colleagues in the States as well have been very sort of involved in advocacy work in responding to regulatory proposals, doing comment letters, I think is what they call it. We do a lot of that here as well, but largely through the FMLC. So I've participated in working groups on digital assets. And, you know, it's kind of really important actually to exchange views with people in the industry, people from other law firms, people from businesses in the industry to really think about what things mean and where the legal and regulatory framework should develop.
Could you talk to the FMLC, maybe for our listeners, just describe?
For sure, of course, yes. So the FMLC is the Financial Markets Law Committee. So it's a body that's established to identify areas of legal uncertainty in regulations and law, I guess, affecting the city. So, you know, they work across the financial sector in the same way. So they have sort of forums, is what they call it, dedicated to bank regulation, to securities regulation, to asset management, insurance, etc. And then from time to time, they also set up specific working groups. So digital assets, for example, has been the topic of at least two working groups that I know of that I've participated in. And, you know, that brings together people from industry, from law firms, and, you know, sort of who, you know, we take a bit of text, a proposal, whether issued by the regulator or HM Treasury or even the Law Commission, I mean, the work it's been doing in this space. And we look at it and sort of comment on, is this certain? You know, is the result we're proposing sort of certain, or is there something that needs to be addressed to make it more certain? So that's really interesting work.
It's very much one of the strengths, I think, of the UK, that consultative process of exploring pros and cons of law pragmatically. You mentioned that in collaboration with your international colleagues, you're seeing some of perhaps the US and European regulation in the digital asset space. And in the work you're looking to suggest, for example, with your clients, that there might be a jurisdictional choice for them. Are you seeing any trends that you can describe?
Yeah, so, you know, it's really interesting. I think at a high level, I would say, if you want to know about the commercial law, sort of implications of digital assets, you look to the US. Because they've had the crypto winter, so there's a lot of litigation going on now. And they've also had the amendments to the UCC, Article 12, to sort of address some of these key questions. Is this property? How do you take security, et cetera? And that's really fascinating to see just how quickly they've kind of been able to go with that. That's probably because they're starting in the US with statute. We're starting here purely with the common law, right? But what they can't get together so far is the regulatory framework. And that's where Europe is leading. So we, of course, have had the EU's market in crypto assets regulation, MiCAR or MiCAR, I say MiCAR. Europeans, I think, say MiCAR. And in the UK, of course, ours is developing. So we're not taking exactly the same approach as MiCAR in terms of having a sort of big bang, all-encompassing bit of regulation that's going to regulate kind of crypto once and for all. We're taking a more phased approach in the UK, starting with the fiat referencing stablecoins, the digital settlement assets under the Financial Services and Markets Act 2023. And then HM Treasury is looking at consulting on phase two, what it calls phase two and beyond, looking at other crypto assets and specifically looking at what activities it wants to regulate. So I think that's really interesting, actually, about the UK's approach, that we're kind of focusing on not so much on what, you know, on the definition of crypto assets and what sort of asset is in scope, but really what activities we want to see regulated and what outcomes we want. Because, you know, in this space, this idea of same risk, same regulatory outcome has become really important. It's often repeated, especially in this area. And so that's very much kind of leading the way the Treasury is thinking about that. So it's really kind of a toss-up, right? Because, you know, if you want to know kind of how you operate within the regulatory framework, what licenses you need, et cetera, you're better off, of course, coming to, you know, to a European market. Of course, if you set up in an EU jurisdiction with MiCAR, you get the benefits of the passport, for example. So that must be very attractive to some people. In the UK, I think some people also like our approach, actually, of kind of waiting and see, and they like the opportunity to influence where we're going with things. And so that's also attractive. But it, you know, English law at the moment, you know, we were very lucky to have the work that the English Law Commission has done in this space, but it's still relatively slow in kind of formulating a basic answer to, you know, is when you have a crypto asset, do you actually have property? And, you know, how do you take a good security interest over that? And, you know, I think once that question is settled, then I think it becomes really powerful. The sort of the UK offering becomes really powerful. But
time will tell. And slowly but surely, perhaps. One of the broad things I know we discussed in the prep was on the idea of unbacked or backed crypto assets. And particularly for Greengage, we're quite keen on seeing opportunities for these new technologies to open up financing for businesses primarily. I'd love to hear your take on where you see the unbacked or backed crypto distinction playing out in the legal context.
Yeah. So, I mean, with my sort of regulatory lawyer hat on, it doesn't necessarily matter. So the framework, you know, the frame of reference I have in my mind is that you have this taxonomy whereby some types of crypto assets are regulated, and those tend to be the backed crypto assets because they resemble traditional financial assets. So you have a crypto which is a security effectively, or you have a crypto like a stable coin which can be classified as e-money. But in fact, that's where MiCAR is taking you, where you have the e-money token. And then in the UK as well, with the phase one under the Financial Services and Markets Act, this digital settlement asset, fiat referencing stablecoin that can be used for payments, that's also e-money. And then, but then there are certain other types of backed crypto assets, so sort of commodities referencing crypto assets, for example, where it's less certain at the moment, at least speaking from the perspective of the UK, whether they're regulated or not. On the MiCAR, that's very clear. It's an asset reference token. And so that will be clearly regulated. But for now, in the UK, it's not entirely certain what the sort of, you know, the regulatory analysis of certain backed crypto assets. Mm-hmm. And then on backed crypto assets, so Bitcoin, I think everyone agrees in the UK that's unregulated, because it's quite a unique sort of asset. You haven't got an issue. You know, we're used to financial assets, which are claimed, which are, you know, somebody owes you something, the financial obligations. This is very unique in that the value is purely what other people think the value is worth. It's quite incredible. We used to have the debate in the past about whether that was actually more like a commodity, a digital gold or something, was the thinking. So I mean, ultimately, in terms of where this is all going, you know, eventually we'll have regulation across the piece for all types of crypto assets, I think, except maybe, you know, things like non-fungible tokens might not be considered financial assets. And you can imagine people tokenizing things like ID and that sort of stuff, or interesting cars and that sort of stuff, which probably won't be financial assets, would be my guess. Because, you know, you don't regulate that today as a financial asset. So why would you do that in the future? But generally, all sorts of crypto assets which are financial assets or resemble financial assets, I think, will become regulated in some way or the other in the UK and in the EU. And I'm not sure, you know, the extent to which on-back crypto will kind of, you know, remain prevalent. Something, you know, which is like a Bitcoin, entirely permissionless, not really representing anything. I'm not sure. I think more and more the technology will be used to represent actual assets or things that exist, but, you know, now in crypto asset form. And so, you know, we'll become used to tokenization and having digital assets, but it will be, I think, tokenizing things that we can recognize even today. So that's where I kind of think we'd end up.
And maybe we even lose sight of it being tokenized. We just consider it being digitized.
Well, quite. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, people always make the analogy of the digital bearer bond, right? And
yes.
I kind of think, you know, that is very apt. I kind of think if in Victorian times people had the technology, that's how you would do it, right? You need, you know, financial assets which are traded in capital markets. They have to be negotiable. So they have to be sort of transferable pretty freely. And DLT can do that. It can do that, you know. You know, you just, I don't know, I guess, transfer the keys or whatever the technology will end up being, and you know, that's, you know, pretty instantaneous, pretty final, pretty amazing, really. So yes, I kind of think it will. You know, we will see tokenization. I mean, subject to, you know, it's becoming sort of cost effective to do that. But I think, you know, there's another sort of area of thinking that many of the sort of potential benefits of digital assets in terms of efficiencies and shortening the settlement cycles and just making operational processes more efficient can be achieved in other ways as well. The current systems just making better use of technology, etc. So, you know, there's a question really as to how beneficial people will think it is to sort of, you know, represent everything via some sort of token, but it's entirely possible, I think.
Moving on slightly to the current discussion, which had been something that hit the press around the idea of gambling representing what we're seeing in the cryptocurrency trading space. I know that's slightly been refuted at very high levels. One case I wanted to explore a bit further was the Tulip trading case. And if you could just give a précis of kind of how that is and maybe your thoughts on how that impacts the discussion we're having around the evolution of crypto assets.
So yeah, Tulip trading. So this was a Court of Appeal decision. So it allowed an appeal against a jurisdiction challenge, finding that the argument that Bitcoin developers owed fiduciary duties to users on the network had a chance of success. So the court did not decide that there were fiduciary duties. I always have to explain that when talking to non-English lawyers, especially, it's like, fiduciary duties, really? Like, no, the court did not decide that once and for all that fiduciary duties are owed in digital asset network, but they said, you know, there is a question, a serious question to be tried, and so they decided to, you know, for the case to go back to first instance for that question to be decided. It's a really interesting case. I mean, my main takeaways from it is one that, you know, a bit like what I was explaining at the start in terms of how our firm's practice is kind of evolving. It's really traditional being applied in this space. So, you know, you can't think, you know, in with some sort of idea that this is all new and all different and it's, you know, it's complete sort of autonomy and we can do what we want. You can't exclude entirely that the legal system will apply existing principles or will find that, you know, it's a question to consider. So I think that's, you know, that's really interesting. I don't know where, you know, what, you know, where the decision will end up, where it returned to first instance, if they will find there are fiduciary duties owed in these circumstances. I don't think they will. I mean, I don't think the law of fiduciary duties as it stands really is sort of applicable, but still it's this idea that you have such an old, long-standing concept of English law being applied that is possibly being applied that is really fascinating. And the other sort of main point for me is, well, how does this analysis that there could be a fiduciary duty and the sort of specific duty that is being alleged by the applicants is that the software developers may, in certain circumstances, because they owe this fiduciary duty, have to introduce a software patch, you know, with the effect that an owner's assets are transferred into safety. So if you've lost your Bitcoin, they're saying there's a fiduciary duty on the developers to introduce this patch that will mean that you get back your Bitcoin. And that is also really sort of, it's a really powerful idea because a lot of what the English Law Commission's work around the nature of crypto assets from an English commercial law perspective, is this property? And if so, what type of property it is? And so we're pretty settled that it's property. There have been all sorts of interim judgments kind of assuming and deciding that digital assets, you know, can be property. But what type of property it is has been a question, right? And the English Law Commission is recommending that digital assets be characterized as the third type of property. So traditionally, you have things in possession on the one hand as one type of property, and then things in action. So things in possession, sort of physical assets that you can physically own, physically possess. Things in action, you can only really sort of enforce that by suing. So it's a legal right? It's a pure obligation. And they're saying, well, it's actually somewhere in the middle. It's a sort of hybrid of that because it's tangible. Digital assets is represented by code, but it's not as pure and intangible as, say, a pure claim. A pure claim is purely a legal right. Digital assets is something, you know, I won't go so far as saying that it's physical, but there's a degree of tangibility about when you own that right, when you can control that bit of code by having the right keys, etc., that you might almost think that it's an analogous to physically sort of owning something. And so they're saying, you know, digital assets can be in that third category along with other types of property potentially. And so, I mean, one type of property that already occupies a third category, you might say, is the bearer asset. So it's, you know, sort of what we call documentary intangible. So it's a claim, so it's intangible, it's a debt claim, but it's represented by a bit of paper such that the paper is the debt effectively, right? And so when you have the bit of paper, you own the debt. And that's a really great quality because it means that you get that negotiability that I was talking about. And you the piece of paper, then you become the owner. And so if digital assets are sort of something like that, they're occupying a third category, maybe akin to documentary intangibles, then this idea that somebody could have a duty to restore your lost assets, it to me doesn't quite fit with the idea that you might have a, you know, something which is a negotiable instrument so that, you know, you can get good title from a thief. You know, this idea that the specific duty that's being alleged, I think, is really interesting on that issue as well.
It's very interesting on two levels. One, I remember when I cut my teeth in financial services, the whole bearer instruments discussion around AML was quite significant. In a digitized representation, as we're discussing, the tracing of these assets is much easier because you can use coin forensics, for example, to know exactly where is this moving to, if not necessarily the underlying owner. So that could be one analysis that helps to suggest this is perhaps a better way of doing bearer instruments. But the one that I think is more interesting for me is, we've seen with stable coins, for example, that there is an option to, and you can classify this as a fiduciary responsibility, to reset the issuance if someone is found to have been defrauded, freeze the original coin, and then release anew to that individual. If the Bitcoin developers are told to do that for the overall code, Bitcoin Core, it's a very interesting kind of, because it removes that whole nature of what we were just discussing around the unbacked. The question then is, If you're holding somebody to account, they are backing.
They are backing the asset, exactly. And, you know, and Bitcoin is a terrible example for any of that sort of thing,
yes.
Right? Because, you know, this came up with a jurisdictional challenge, right? Does the English court have jurisdiction? They say they might.
Yeah.
But, you know, is that really going to be binding in other, you know, other jurisdictions, given it's an entirely permissionless network? So, you know, in other cases where you have something which is permission, which is backed, you can introduce these sorts of duties contractually. It doesn't even have to be a fiduciary duty, right? Or any sort of implied duty. I mean, we have, under English law, very high thresholds for implication of duties. You know, if people want these sorts of duties, typically they say that in the contract. and in a permission system, you can do that, right? So in a way, I agree with the Court's appeal that it is a question. And again, it's going to this thing. You can't ignore traditional legal concepts on the basis that it is new technology and the law doesn't apply. But I said, I firmly expect when it gets decided again on the actual merits of the argument that it will find it. Maybe there's some duty, but it's not a fiduciary duty. That's for sure.
My last question, if I may, we've been discussing some of the commercial and legal implications of these new technologies as they're tested. It seems litigation is one of the primary reasons that this is being tested, if there's a bankruptcy or a fraud case. Do you think that's the right approach, or do you think there's another way to do this, or do we just kind of wait and see?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's kind of how it's playing out in the US. In the US, they're already working on the amendment to the Uniform Commercial Code. But I think the sort of questions my colleagues are telling me are coming up in the litigation is really clarifying huge swathes of these things, right? And so I think that's quite powerful. So it's unfortunate that people invested in the various sort of players who went down and lost assets. Really, really unfortunate. And, you know, from a financial stability perspective, I don't think we want that, right? We don't really want to have the contagion of a crypto winter sort of across the globe if this asset class or these types of assets were to become systemic. But having the questions tried in court has become quite beneficial. And I think the Law Commission is also in its sort of recommendations as to how to go forward on this is thinking along the same lines. It's saying, look, the common law rather has all the tools to decide these questions, to develop incrementally over time as it has with all sorts of issues. But maybe in very specific circumstances, you might need statute to sort of intervene and clarify certain things more quickly than, you know, waiting for a case to come up, the right case, and for that case to go all the way and up to the Supreme Court for you to have something sort of authoritative. And then they also say there should be a role for sort of expert guidance, I guess something like a financial markets law committee, some sort of forum like that where you have experts giving their views on that. I mean, we've had already some very successful interventions of that nature with the UK Jurisdictional Task Force, their sort of statements on various questions around digital assets, like, are they property? Can you have digital securities under English law? And that's, you know, those things are very persuasive. The Law Commission's work as well has also been very, very persuasive, being cited in all sorts of litigation, not only in the States, I think, actually. I think that someone in one of the cases, one of the Celsius bankruptcy, I think one of the judgments made a reference to the Law Commission's work. And so, yes, it's, you know, we need case law and precisely because of kind of the way Tulip has played out, that has shown the value of case law. You need judges to say, this is the law. It's there and it's there to be applied. But, you know, statute has a role in making things more certain, like we've seen with kind of traditional intermediated securities and the financial collateral arrangements regulations, which, you know, has kind of clarified and given all the certainty to being able to take a security over intermediate securities, which, you know, was a question. There were significant doubts under the common law regarding whether, you know, fixed to what you need to get a fixed charge, for example, versus a floating charge. The FCAR framework has function to introduce a lot of certainty in that space, even though there are still doubts, and we're still hoping that, you know, case law will develop to make things ever more certain. But, you know, that's worked well in that space. And then, yeah, we then, I think, just, you know, rely on commentators to give opinions, to say, this is how we think it should work, etc., so that, you know, the next time there is a case, we have a body of opinion to turn to and to argue that that's how it should work.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your contributions, both on the podcast and also in your broader work to kind of bring this space forward. It's been a pleasure, Felicia. Thank you.
No, thank you very much.